Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. This is part two of Richard York. Show title is called Follow the Money, Chasing Cheaters, Fraud, and Con Artists, an interview with securities fraud investigator Richard York, part two. If you didn't hear part one, it is available now. Make sure that you go to iTunes. You can get the podcast, 75 other podcasting places. We have the show, and make sure that you check it out. So that way it goes into your device, wherever, however you listen to it, whatever device you have, it will get in there right away. Of course, all the shows are brought to you by Kensington Books. Go to kensingtonbooks.com for more information on their new releases and their authors. So without any further ado, let's go right now to your host of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. Welcome back to part two in our discussion with Richard York. If you missed the first one, go back and pick it up because we covered a lot of very interesting things. And we're going to get into some even more financial shenanigans in this one. The bio, Richard's bio is online everywhere, but just to kind of bring you up to date a little bit, the high points. He has a 40-year career in law enforcement, the bulk of which from 1984 to 2011. He was in the office of the Kansas Securities Commissioner in Wichita, Kansas, where he became the director of enforcement. And they oversaw the registration and enforcement of investor-related laws under the Kansas Uniform Securities Act, and among others. And he personally handled over 300 investigations and supervised 1,000 more. He's also an accomplished guitarist. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, last time you were with us, you know, we talked about oil and gas fraud. We talked about security, what they were. You gave us some great definitions of stuff about various financial investigations that went on at that time, and we're going to shift to another area. Many of our listeners may have heard the term Ponzi scheme and pyramid scheme, but they're not really sure what it means. What exactly is a Ponzi scheme or pyramid scheme?
Okay. I'll perhaps give some short definitions of it, and then maybe if you want, we can kind of get into some case examples, which will make this a lot more memorable. A pyramid scheme is simply one where a group of investors come in at a bottom level. They transfer their money to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. The typical Ponzi scheme that we were dealing with had four levels to it. There would be eight investors on the bottom, four at the next level, two at the next, and one on top. The first case that I had, let me go on with that, because what happens is the people that are at the very bottom pay their money in, and it shifts entirely to the top of the pyramid, and then that person gets bumped off. The pyramid now doesn't have a top, but if you look at it, it splits in two, and you now have three levels, but each of those two pyramids is now going to recruit eight more people for the bottom, and on and on and on. When these things start up, they just multiply like rabbits. And for the people that are participating, especially the person that originated it, that's in number one slot, it's pure money for them. The people that are at risk are the ones that are at the bottom and in the middle. Now, I'm going to just briefly describe what a Ponzi scheme and kind of contrast the difference. A Ponzi scheme investors' money comes into an enterprise, and that could be any form of business. The money comes in, and any profits that are paid out is not from a legitimate product or a sale of service or anything. It's actually from new investors. How do you get new investors? Basically, word of mouth or advertising. Most cases, it's going to be word of mouth. People just talk, and next thing you know, their neighbors are in it, their relatives are in it. And a Ponzi scheme is basically rolling over the money, but it's for the benefit of one person, and they don't go away. A pyramid scheme, usually the upper level will disappear. So that's the brief explanation. This will make a little bit more sense if I can get into some a little bit of storytelling. Would that help you?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Okay, so the first pyramid scheme that I was assigned to was called Airplane. Now, this is a totally fictitious airplane. It doesn't exist other than a chart. And on the chart, there's eight people on the bottom. They're going to be called passengers. Each passenger is going to pay $500 to the next level, which is a crew member. There's four crew members. Those crew members are also going to chip in $500. They're going to pay those to the co-pilots, which are at the next tier up. And finally, all of that money is going to get transferred to tier one. And if I remember right, it's roughly $15,000 that comes in and goes to the pilot. Then the pilot goes off of the chart. And now the chart splits in two. We have two airplanes, but we need eight people for the bottom tier of each one. So those people that were at the crew level have to go out and recruit others underneath them in order for them to advance. And so every time there's an advancement and somebody gets paid out, the airplane splits in two and it continues to multiply. Now, this is what we kind of call a pure money game. There is no legitimate product. There is no legitimate service. And back when these were first cropping up in the I believe it was the early 1990s, it operated under a variety of names. Sometimes it was called Airplane. Sometimes it's called People Helping People. I saw it called Gifting Programs. It's also pretty related to chain letters that you might get in the mail. But people will call it a variety of names to try and avoid being in conflict with the law. Well, the state of Kansas did not have a law that specifically outlawed pyramid schemes. But we felt it was a crime, and we brought it under the Securities Act, saying that it was an investment contract, an investment of money into a common enterprise for the purpose of making a profit through the managerial efforts of another. It's called the four-prong test. And each time this gets recharted, then it's multiplying, and more and more people are at risk. The other thing that's significant about it, that on the chart, people don't use their real names. They were instructed to use some form of alias, a nickname that they might have had in their youth or something like that. But someone would keep track of what those nicknames were and be able to know who the real person was so that the money could go to the right place. It was always cash. Always cash. Never checks. So just off the bat, does that sound a little bit suspicious? I think the answer is yes. It presents some real problems for us as investigators because if you remember back in part one, I said our bread and butter and the best bullet in our gun was our ability to issue subpoenas to banks. This money was not being transacted through banks. People were using aliases. So we didn't know how to really get to the bottom of it. The complaint came to my attention via a county attorney in far western Kansas. It was in Garden City, which is about a 3.5-hour drive from us. And he called and said, hey, this thing is going crazy. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of people out here that are participating in it. And he said, someday this is going to crash, and we're just going to have a huge problem. And we agreed. So two of us went out to Garden City, myself and another investigator. And normally when we're doing investigations, we walk in the shadows. We don't make any big scene about us coming into town, you know, wearing the white hats and riding the horses that flare up or anything like that. We prefer to be very quiet about our investigations because it's more effective. In this particular case, we went to the local law enforcement facility, which was a joint police and sheriff department facility, and asked what they knew. Well, they had some leads on some people that may have participated, but there was always kind of a smile on the local law enforcement officer's face. And what we were getting from that is, good luck with this, buddy, because you're going to have a time getting answers from these people. And that's exactly right. We ended up suggesting that people that were victimized by it, in other words, the victims are the ones that paid the money in the bottom, but they didn't get paid out, would call the Crime Stoppers phone number. It's an anonymous call, and you can report anything. So we asked that they publish that number and say, hey, if you got information about this, who's in it, call this number. And we thought, well, that might help us get some leads. Well, it kind of backfired. We were absolutely flooded with names of people. When you're a law enforcement officer and you're from out of town and you come into town, you're not necessarily the most liked person there. You're viewed as an outsider, and people don't necessarily want to cooperate. But yet, we had some names. Now, some of those names were law enforcement people. They were people that were on the police department, the sheriff department. We even had tips that said it was a court reporter and a district court judge. Well, I'm telling you, that'll put some starch in our shorts, because how can we take a criminal case to a district court judge who may have been involved in this scheme? And if the judge denied it, do you believe the judge? So it really, really put some unusual issues forward with what was going on. Nonetheless, we marched forward and we went to talk to some of these people. One of the persons that we were given actually was a very reputable businessman and lived on the country club, on a very nice house. In that community, it was probably a $750,000 home. Now, Garden City is in western Kansas, and that's a very arid area. Although they grow crops, it's always irrigated. But the rest of the grounds, unless you've got an irrigation system, it's going to be pretty much dust and dirt and tumbleweeds. So we go out to the Garden City. We have the address, and we've got the name. We go out, and this is a very nice house. And the front of the house, there's an entrance with a wrought iron gate off of the street, but there's a drive that goes around back. Well, we didn't know whether we should drive around back. So we went, parked on the street, and started to go through the gate. And we no sooner got clear of the front gate than a woman comes out on the front porch. She was probably about 30, 35 years of age, and screams at us, "Get out of the yard! Get out of the yard!" And we're going, what's going on, you know, because we don't see anyone. Or she says, "Rattlesnakes, it's full of rattlesnakes." and so we do the proper thing. We retreat. It doesn't matter how many bullets you have in a gun, you may not be fast enough to shoot a rattlesnake. So she, from the front porch, says, drive around back. And so we drove around back, and she met us at the back porch. And I said, "Are you serious about the snakes?" She said, "Oh, absolutely. We live on the golf course, and the people that are playing golf, they've got hooks to be able to hook those snakes and fling them out of the way so they can finish their golf game." I mean, it's a normal thing for these people. It isn't normal for Richard York. So, you know, they didn't train me on this when I went through basic training.
You and Indiana Jones, right?
That's right. And I don't particularly like snakes. You know, I don't want them to be bedtime companions. So we go around back. She invites us inside, and, you know, it's a little bit tense because, you know, I think she was a little bit worried about us. And so we showed her our badges and our credentials. She says, I know who you guys are. She said, I don't know your names, but come in, sit down. What can I get you to drink? So she offered us beverages, and my buddy took coffee, and I said, I'll just have bottled water if you have it. And the reason why, I was a little bit afraid what might be in a container that was unopened. So, again, we're out of our environment, and we have sensed that the people out there don't trust us. So we sit down and talk to her, and she tells us, she says, I know what you're here about. And she says, boys, there's hundreds, if not 1,000 people that are in on this deal. And she said, it's widespread. And she said, I'd love to help you with names, but she says, I just can't do that in good conscience. And she said, here's the reason why. When you guys are done with this, you're going to get in your car and you're going to drive back to Wichita or Topeka, wherever you're from, and we're going to be left with a huge problem out here with people that, you know, people that participate to go to church together, they're in civic clubs together, they're business people, this is customers. It's everybody in the community at every level of the community is involved in this thing. And when you guys leave, it's just going to be turmoil and a lot of hard feelings. And so we sat and talked about other things because we weren't going to get anywhere. And, you know, she was probably the wisest person that we talked to in a two-week period when we were out there because she nailed it on the head. Prosecuting a case like that criminally is just a massive undertaking in the way of costs and manpower, and what do you get out of it? It's not our typical fraudster. These are people who just did this to entertain themselves. We left that place, and we had a list of people to talk to. We went to another house, and this was just a picture book house, little cottage, white house, and walked up to the porch, and it was an evening newspaper that's delivered. And as we got there, the paper was laying on the porch. I picked it up so I would have something to hand to the occupants. Knocked on the door. A woman came to the door, and we told her who we were, and we showed our badges and our credentials and said, could we come in and talk to you? And she said, yes, you can. And with that kind of a tone, yes, you can, but it's my husband you need to be talking to. And she called him. He was in another room, and she said, get out here. And he came out, and we badged him and told him who we were. And, I mean, you could see the sweat popping out on his forehead. And he happened to be a car salesman. And she sat
Married
on a chair.
To a church lady.
She sat on a chair opposite from him and glared at him the whole time. And he kind of told us the same thing. He says, you know, I guess I'd rather go to jail than snitch out my friends. And he said, these are people that I've sold cars to, and I've gone to church with, and he said, I just can't do it. He said, I'd rather lose my money than kind of be a rat fink. And so, you know, I think she had a piece of his ass by the time we left. But we didn't get any answers. And we were out there for 5 days, and then we came home for the weekend. And at the end of the 5 days, or the fifth day when we were out there, one of the detectives said, you know, the hotel that you're staying at, they've actually had meetings out there to promote this thing. And the owners of the hotel, these two guys, purportedly were involved in the scheme. And, oh, my gosh. You know, we're going, we can't leave our rooms with any paper evidence or with our computers. So anytime we wanted to go eat, we had to take the stuff with us because we were afraid somebody would have a passkey and be able to go in and see what we were doing, see our reports. And so we got to where, okay, well, let's just move out of here. And so that was the last day. We came home. We kind of regrouped when we went out there the next day. And we really weren't making much more headway other than it was bigger. I mean, we were getting leads that now it was probably 2,000 or 3,000 people that was involved out in western Kansas, not just in one city, but the whole area of western Kansas. And we were in the headlines of the newspaper. People were following us. We didn't know whether it was people from the local media who was following us to see so that they could get a scoop on what was going on, or if it was actually participants so they could see who was maybe talking to the law enforcement officials. But we were being followed. So we went out there the following Monday and tried to make some more. And we went to a couple's home, and they were both present. It was in the evening, early evening, and they were off work. And they said, you know, guys, I know you're nice guys, and this is our problem, and we know all about it, but we just can't talk about this. You know, this is our friends. And so we got nowhere. But, I mean, they were extremely nervous, more so than anybody else that we talked to in the community. So we left. And we went to a smaller, basically, motel, and where we were parked on the ground level, so our cars were immediately in front of the windows, so we could see our automobiles, and we could also see in the lots if anybody was basically doing surveillance on us. And about 7:45 the next morning, I was had agreed to meet my buddy out front, and I opened the door, and in the door jamb, dead center in the door jamb, was a Black Widow spider turned upside down, and it was dead. I shut the door. I came back, and I called my buddy, and I said, you won't believe what I just found. I said, this is a message. And it isn't a message from God either. It's just a message from this community. So I called him, and he said, let's check our car. So we went outside, and we literally crawled underneath our cars to see if there was bombs or explosives underneath. There wasn't. We packed up our stuff and went to the law enforcement center and called my boss and told him what was going on. He said, head back to Wichita. He said, we're going to meet with our attorneys and see what we can do. So that's what we did. And we go, you know, we've got a lot of names, but we don't have enough evidence to be able to criminally prosecute. Because in a criminal case, you have to have beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, so it's not just that you suspect somebody. You have to be able to prove it. And we weren't to that level. But the securities commissioner has some unusual powers. We can also file our own civil lawsuits. Now, I would be hard-pressed to name another law enforcement agency that can do that other than the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. They do that a lot. But most law enforcement agencies can't do that. We also can issue an administrative order called a cease and desist order. Well, that's issued by our office, and if there's a hearing, we basically hire a hearing officer to hear the case. And, you know, again, the level of proof is far, far less than it would require in court. So that's what we did. We issued, I think, 150 cease and desist orders. We would not do it based on one person's notice to us. We usually relied on two or three. If their name came up two or three times, we probably named them. So that's pretty much how we handled this type of pyramid scheme. The same type of program kicked up in the Wichita community under a different name. It was called People Helping People. And in that particular case, we filed civil lawsuits to try and recover money. So we took these kind of actions that are short of a criminal case, but it really stressed our office's staffing to be able to do those kinds of things. So then we did what really made the most sense. We wrote a new law, and it's called the Pyramid Law, and we passed it so that it was not a part of the Securities Act. It's part of the general criminal code, and it became the responsibility for every law enforcement officer and every county and district attorney in the state of Kansas to enforce it. Bingo, we're off the hook. So that was the strategic approach that we made. Now, I do want to mention one other thing. We were tasked with finding, the commissioner says, well, if we can't go after everyone, let's at least find who it was that first brought it to this city. And indeed, we finally did do that. And I mentioned this couple that was nervous, very nervous when we were in their home. And we found out at a later time through depositions and sworn statements that they had actually received back the pot from the very first payout that was made in their community. It was to a relative of theirs. And they had the money in the house. And while this sworn testimony was going on, and I was able to ask questions, I said, where was it in the home? And we found out it was in the freezer. It was in a plastic, like a Ziploc bag, $15,000, and it was inside a meatloaf inside the freezer. That is the truth. I guess as Paul Ferry says, that's the rest of the story. So anyhow, we went through that cycle of way too many pyramid schemes that we were investigating, and really they didn't come to a halt until after we passed the state law that basically prohibited any kind of pyramid schemes. Now, I do have to make mention that sometimes pyramid schemes are associated with multi-level marketing programs.
Right.
And there is we have to be very careful. Not all multi-level marketing programs are pyramid schemes. They're usually pyramids, or sometimes they call them matrixes, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are illegal. The test to that is the product that they're selling one that most consumers would desire to have? Is it something useful? And if the answer is yes, people are buying the product without participating in the program, without participating in the pyramid, then it's basically left alone. The Federal Trade Commission also investigates pyramid schemes. So it goes on but I think we pretty well put a halt to it in the state of Kansas. So that's how a pyramid scheme works. Ponzi schemes function differently. They started up, Charles Ponzi was a scoundrel back in 1930 in Boston, and it was hard times for people, and he had a program he called a postage stamp exchange program, and he was dealing with foreign postage stamps and said that he could make a lot of money because with the exchange rate that was going on with it. Well, that may have been true. There might have been a little bit of money, but people were pulling their life savings and giving to this guy, and I don't know, I cannot remember how much money he took in. But basically, the purpose of the program for trading stamps went by the wayside, and it was just money in for him to use. And anybody that wanted their money, they were being paid with the latest people to put the money in. And this guy was living a very wealthy life. Ponzi schemes are much more desirable for securities investigators to investigate because you have a real scoundrel that's scheming behind it. And you have true investors that are going to lose their money. I had a case, you know that I came from the police department at Arkansas City, and I was with the agency, I don't know, about 10 years, and we got a tip that a local stockbroker down there was running some type of fraudulent program. And so we had enough detailed information that I applied for a search warrant, and we basically went in and took down his office. We deliberately waited for him to leave the office because we found out from customers that he had a gun collection inside, and he was known to have a gun in his desk. So we didn't want to risk anybody getting hurt from our side or his side or staff or anything like that. So we waited until he actually left the office. And then we went in with I think there was four or five of us from my office and local law enforcement too. And we did the search warrant. Now, the only thing more devastating to a crook than the arrest, the actual handcuffing arrest, is if you do a search warrant and you take all their goodies. And the goodies would be all of the paperwork that's got all of the investor information, all of the banking records, all of the computers, basically anything that will help build our case. And our search warrants are very broad in what we ask for. At the same time, when we take that stuff, that's a lot of volume of records that have to be gone through and computers that have to be analyzed, and it's very time-consuming to do that. So sometimes we don't make the arrest immediately. We wait until we've done some analysis, confirm the number of victims that we have, and then we put it together. You know, there's a risk of whether the person will leave. Usually if they're pretty stable in the community, they hang around and hire an attorney and try and negotiate something in advance of us filing the case. We have that happen many, many times. This particular case, I think we charged the guy with 47 felonies. He ended up doing a plea deal and pled guilty to eight counts of securities fraud. And I think the total losses were around $300,000. We had about 30 victims in that particular case. Now, the victims, none of them knew that they were victims until we notified them. And, you know, for me, that was kind of interesting because that was the town that I was a law enforcement officer in, and so they're not hearing from Lieutenant York on the police department. They're hearing from Special Investigator York. So it was kind of a unique circumstance for me. But we've had a lot of Ponzi schemes over the years. Gary Fulton was one of my investigators, and he had a case on a guy. I'll just use his first name. Cecil was his name, and I think he was about 70 years of age. The scheme that he operated was basically sold to farm and agricultural people because that was where he made his living originally. And he had quite a few contacts in the farm community in Kansas, Nebraska, and other states in the Midwest. And he said that he had found out, quote, the banker's secret, end of quote. That was his premise, that he had this the banker's secret to know how really to make money with investments. And he would have programs that he would call, they had quirky names like Cycle 120, the club, and these were investments that were typically 6 months, 9 months, or a year in duration, and they would pay out someplace between 50 and maybe 80% in a single year. As an a farmer would invest money, and he would later get his annual statement from this guy. He'd go, holy cow, I'm making 10 times what I am at the bank. I think I'll tell my brother about it. I think I'll tell my children about it, my grown children. And word of mouth would spread. And this guy did no advertising at all. It was all word of mouth. And it spread. And he ran it for 14 years. Now, that's an incredible amount of time for someone to run a scheme and not get caught. And how he got caught was one of our victims from Kansas said, I've got some health issues. I need, and he gave an amount of money, I think it was $150,000 or something like that, to be able to pay some serious medical bills. And this guy, the suspect, was not coming up with the money. He was giving excuses and excuses. And finally, the guy called the local county attorney's office, who referred him to my office. And we said, could you make copies of the paperwork that he's sent to you in your agreements? Yeah. Either fax that or mail that to us. And he did. And Gary Fulton and I looked at the information. And we go, this is a complete scam. We can tell by looking at the paperwork that this makes no sense. And the other thing is the victims never get 1099 forms from a legitimate source. Like if you have money in your bank and you're making interest, if you have investment money with a brokerage firm, you're going to get 1099. So there's going to be interest that's reported and you have to pay taxes on. This guy didn't bother issuing any of those. He didn't phony those up, although he probably could have. So we knew it was a scam. Well, problem number one, we went back and got the investor's original checks, found out where those cleared through, subpoenaed the bank records. Now, our subpoenas, I may not have mentioned this, when we issue a subpoena to a financial institution, they have it has a secrecy clause. It's the last paragraph. You are forbidden from revealing the existence of this subpoena or your compliance to anyone, including the account holder. So when we subpoena a suspect's account, the bank does not notify them. Again, it allows us to operate in the shadows, gather our information so we've got all the answers, until the point in time where we want to confront the suspect. And that's always interesting. One of the other tools that we have in our arsenal is that there is a statutory law. It's a felony to file a false information with a securities investigator or with any of the staff with the Securities Commission. So if you lie to us, it's a new felony, just like it would be if you lied to an FBI agent. We always like to have that as the final backup, because if they've lied to the investors, will they lie to us? We give them a chance to come forward, and we have it. We call it we're going to have a come to Jesus talk. We're going to sit down with you, and we're going to lay out some of the facts that we have and see if you tell us the truth. From our perspective, we really don't care if you lie or if you tell the truth. If you tell the truth, at least it shows you've got some remorse for what you've done, and we've got an admission, which will make the case go a little smoother in court. But if you lie to us, we will have recorded that, and we're going to use that against you in a court. And that's just one more felony, and it's almost a certainty you will be charged with a criminal felony case if you lie to the investigators. So, you know, I've given some contrasts here between how our office works and how the traditional police officer on the street works. And there's a significant difference. A lot of trust is entailed in what we do. And there's checks and balances. You know, anything that before we issue a subpoena, it goes to the director of enforcement for approval. Then it goes to a staff attorney. Sometimes it'll go to the general counsel for approval. So there's a lot of people that are looking over what we're doing, but we know what's going to pass, and you know, through our experience. And so that's now I've kind of described, you know, on this Cecil's program, the money came in, and he basically was paying for the lifestyle of his family and his excursions to the casinos in Nevada and some elaborate vacations and stuff. We only had two investors in the state of Kansas that were victims, but we knew of a lot of investors in other states. So we filed our case first, and Gary Fulton went to, I think it was Gresham, Oregon, and participated in the search warrant, and Cecil was arrested. We had a warrant for him at that time. And Gary went to the local jail to see if he would talk, and the guy agreed to talk to Gary. And it only took a few minutes for this guy to know that we've got all of the answers. And he let out a big sigh, and he said, "I'm glad it's over." He had been living with the guilt of doing this, but he could not stop. He could not stop what he was doing for one reason. He said the rest of his family didn't know that it was a scam. I have a little hard time believing that family members could be working around here all that time. But, you know, the same thing kind of happened with Bernie and the big security scam that the SEC handled. So it is possible. It's just...
Well, you've talked a lot about the techniques that you've used, you know, the yes. sophisticated ones and whatever, but I understand that you've also used some that were a little less sophisticated, like dumpster diving.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess I had some fame with that in our office. I probably use that more often than anybody else. Basically, there's a lot of case law that will say that if you have moved your trash out to the curb, that it's fair game. Anybody can go through that trash, and so and you, it doesn't require a search warrant. And so when I had a suspect in a business that was not cooperating, I would wait until they were closed, and sometimes I would do surveillance to see if they carried any trash out, because usually I would know who the employees are. And I would then take the bags of trash and take it back to my office and sort through it. Sometimes stuff was torn up, and, you know, it's a real mess when you've got slices of uneaten pizza and snotty Kleenexes, and you're trying to pull out a bank statement, you know. But sometimes that's how I found out the financial institutions that were being used. Now, people get all kinds of mail from banks every day. I mean, we do here at our home. Every week we probably get five or six, maybe even more than that, letters for credit cards and stuff. So the first tip-off that it's going to be a real bank account is look at the postmark that's in the upper right-hand corner. If it says postal presort, that means that whoever put that together has done hundreds and maybe thousands of the same things. They're taking them in a big rack to the post office, and it's all going out to everybody. So that's just junk mail. But if it's got a first-class postage meter on it, bingo, I have now hit gold. Because that meter number, all I have to do as a law enforcement officer is call the Postal Inspection Service and tell them, identify who I am, and I say, I need to know who this meter is issued to, and they would give me the information. Now, if it had a postage stamp on it, that's another indication that it is something personal that's going on. Now, I don't have a means of tracking the stamp, but I'm going to look at the rest of the information, the return address on the envelope, to see who that's from. That may be an envelope that's from a customer who's had a beef. And it could be a co-conspirator. You know, it's at least something more tangible to grab hold of. I have paid for trash. I remember one time it was actually a scammer who was operating from his home, and I would do occasional surveillance, just drive-bys, to see what was going on, and I found the date that the trash hauler was going by there. So the very next week, I went by there about 30 minutes early. The trash hauler pulled around the corner. I got stepped out of the car, and I badged him. And the guy, you know, now I'm in a suit, and I'm not in a police uniform, but I badged him. And I said, you're about to pick up trash at address 12220, and I'm interested in that trash. And usually the trash hauler would go, oh, yeah? And I said, here's what I want you to do. You pull up and you grab that trash, and I'm going to pull up beside your truck, on the outside of your truck. I'm going to have my truck open, and you're going to throw that into my truck, and here's a $5 bill for your trouble. You got it, man. You want any more trash? And so they were willing to fill up the truck in my car with stuff I didn't want. But I have actually paid for trash. And then, you know, much to the dismay of the coworkers at my office, I'm bringing that smelly stuff into the office and have to resort through it and look for evidence. So, yeah, I have a reputation for that.
Well, we know you've taught courses for consumers about fraud awareness. What are some of the steps that just the average person can take to avoid being taken? What basics should everybody know about financial crimes?
Okay, well, at your website, I've provided links to some websites that will have educational materials for investors as to what is risky, where scams are likely to be. So all of those websites are something that you should frequent. At a minimum, before you do an investment, look up the number for the local securities commissioner's office within your own state. Every state will have a securities commissioner and staff. And call them and say what it is you're looking at and who it is you're dealing with. They will be able to check and see if that person is registered to sell those kind of products. They'll also be able to tell you whether or not there's been some serious disciplinary history. Disciplinary history means they've been bad boys or bad girls, and that would be a red flag right there. If they've had problems, then it's time to go a different direction. If the investment sounds out of norm for what the times are, you know, right now banks are only paying about 1% on savings. I may be a little bit off, but I won't be off more than 2%, I don't think. And so if you see an investment that's claiming that they're going to pay you 20-30%, there's probably something wrong with that. It's better to investigate beforehand than to have to call it in people like myself and do it afterhand, because the money is probably gone by that point.
Mm. Well, tell us about some of your other cases.
Some other cases. Well, I mentioned some. It's very important for us to be able to do interviews in a very thorough manner and then follow up with that with a detailed report, because that report is what the prosecutor is going to rely on. And ultimately, if there's an arrest made, that report is going to be provided to the defense attorney under full disclosure. So the report has to be very thorough. Interviews can be really interesting because I may be interviewing a doctor who's a surgeon who's lost $20,000 and he doesn't hardly blink at that because he can't afford to go to court and lose the time to be tied up in a court case. So for us, a lot of times doctors are not the best victims to be able to try and present. But I've interviewed attorneys who have lost money. I interviewed a geochemist in Arizona. This was on a gold mining scam. And I got permission to travel out of state. And by the way, I've traveled to 14 different states and also to Canada on investigations. And so anyhow, I went down there to interview this guy. And now we run background checks, criminal background checks, and we also search for bankruptcies and any civil lawsuits on any of the suspects that we're looking at. And this guy was not selling the deal. He was basically working on a mining project. But I found out that he was a convicted felon. And he was convicted of an oil and gas scheme and had recently paid off his restitution. He paid off the restitution from the gold mining scheme that I was now working on. And the golden rule in securities, when you're selling securities, is you have to disclose the good, the bad, and the ugly. Well, if you're a convicted felon, I'm sorry, you've got to tell the investors that, because that could be a risk. What if this guy violates his probation or parole, which he was doing, and he goes to prison? Then could this project move forward? You know, there's risk associated with those kind of things. And more, as I think I mentioned this, that as my career went on, we had more and more felons because they would they would train people in prison how to do scams. Why would you rob a liquor store and maybe walk out with $500 or $600 when you can scam investors and walk away with $500,000? So prisons kind of became a training ground. So anyhow, I've interviewed a lot of people that have educational credentials out the wazoo, you know, that I simply didn't feel I could talk on the same plane. But there's always a way to communicate, and investigators have to have good communication skill. And, of course, then there's hundreds and hundreds of pure investors that are of the retirement type. And one that's rather bizarre comes to mind. It was a fairly small case. There wasn't a lot of money that was lost. I think we might have been looking at $100,000, which is pretty small. But the interview was taking place in a little town north of Wichita, about an hour and a half out. And it was a widow lady, and I'd made an appointment, and I went up, and so she invited me in, and I sat on the chair that was next to the front door, and I'm facing the back of the house, and the house is kind of divided in half. On the right half is, as you go on back, you can see the kitchen and dining area, and on the left half, it's a hallway that goes to some bedrooms. And the woman that I'm interviewing is probably 80, maybe 82 years of age, and she's sitting on a sofa facing me on the right. And I'm asking her the typical questions, the who, what, how, why, when, those kind of things about her investment, and I'm writing notes. And I got a glimpse of something in the hallway. Now, I understood that she was a widow, but I saw somebody, and I glanced down the hallway to the left, and I knew that the woman I'm interviewing could not see down the hallway. And this figure is kind of coming out of the shadows towards me, and it is another woman. She is wearing a negligee. And she stops short of the wall. I could see her, but the woman I'm interviewing couldn't. She smiles at me and gives me a little wave, and I'm not sure exactly what to do with this. Again, they did not cover this in basic training. But I'm sitting there, and I continue to ask my questions, and the woman in the hallway then proceeds to take the negligee off and drop it. Now, for some people, that might be an exciting episode, but this turned out to be the older sister, and she was probably 85 years of age. And I'm seeing things that I wish I had not looked at. I quickly wrapped up the interview and thanked her, and we stepped out on the front porch, and I couldn't help but say something, and I said to the victim, I said, I understood that you lived alone, but I thought I saw somebody down the hallway. I didn't say any more than that. And she said, oh, yeah, that's my sister. She's crazier than alone. And I'm going, okay, we'll just leave it at that. And as I shook her hand to leave, I noticed that there's a mailbox on the front of the house. You know, it's the type that has the flapper door you drop, the mailman drops door. And as I walked out to my car, I'm going, I wonder how many times the mailman has seen this show when he delivers the mail. And all the way back to my office, I was laughing in the car. I had an hour and a half drive, and I go in. Now, usually cops are pretty good about telling stories, but I'm going, Richard, you don't want to be telling this story, because cops are notorious for giving other cops nicknames. And I happen to be the boss in the office, and I'm going, no good nickname could get him out of this episode. So nobody knew this story until after I retired. And then I shared it with a few of them. And so, some of the deals are interesting.
Well, Richard, this has been fantastic. It's just great stories. I love this. Our writer friends out there are really going to like it.
Good.
Yeah. And we appreciate you coming back. We're going to have to do a third show.
Yeah,
there's
well,
not much more to talk about.
I would probably be up for it.
Well, again, thank
you very much.
Thank you very much. And everybody knows that all the shows are online. They're archived. If you missed the first half of this interview, it's available. You can go to my website, the Crime and Science Radio website. Download it from iTunes, like John said. Listen to it. You'll learn a whole lot about how to stay out of financial trouble. And who's coming after you if you don't. Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so
Richard.
Much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Like the same, it's all inside.